Thank you, Bob. I will never again conceive of the Philadelphia Society as an anarchical association. Seeing how strictly they comply with your orders. Don, Lips had sent me, by way of research material suitable for this occasion, a snug little portfolio of about 70 documents. Two of which in particular caught the eye. The first was a financial statement of the Philadelphia Society, dated September 15, 1965, showing a net deficit of $229.07. Attested to by its treasurer, Ed Fulner. The society was primarily burdened in those days by two debts of $100 each, owed respectively to Don Lipset and to me. I had forgotten that I had advanced a part of the incorporation money for the Philadelphia Society. I hadn't forgotten that Don Lipset had done so. Burke, Russell Kirk never lets us forget, spoke of the unincorporated graces, and I doubt that anyone here would disagree with me that these abound quietly, as it is almost demanded that they should, in Don Lipset. Whose creation really this extraordinary society is. It reflects, for one thing, Don's utter disorderliness, but also his quiet devotion to reasonable speculation. Why are we here? What is life's point if man isn't free? What are the permanent things, which the transitory? How can we effectively channel our moral energies? The second document was an account of the first annual meeting of the Philadelphia Society, covered for National Review by Guy Davenport, one of the most interesting minds in America, and in it, he referred to one speaker, among others, the late Stanley Parry, who singled out for attention on that occasion the disharmonious notion that there might be such a thing as a conservative philosophy. His point being that any such formulation came as awkwardly to the lips as a description of, say, German physics. The temptation is great to reminisce, and as one grows older, it is important to resist that temptation, because on the whole, reminiscences tend to bore younger people, and for the most part, for good reason. But it would be to deprive you if I kept from you my keenest memory of Father Parry. It was during the spring of 1951, at a little church in New York City, that Father Parry baptized his old friend Wilmore Kendall into the Catholic Church, while I stood by as godfather to my old mentor. After the ceremony, during which, if I remember the liturgy, Wilmore was required one after another to renounce in Latin most of the things in life he most enjoyed. We drove happily in my little convertible to lunch at Stamford en route. Father Parry suddenly turned and said, Wilmore, do you realize that probably the best thing that could possibly happen to you is if Bill ran into a lamppost right now, causing you to depart this vale of tears? The question before the House, I take it, has to do whether the vale of tears is, however, incompletely in some way staunched by the occupancy at this moment of the White House by Ronald Reagan. What can he do? Exactly almost to the hour, 1 week ago, I was with him in a helicopter Returning to the president's house in the southern part of the island of Barbados from dinner at the house of Miss Colbert, it had been planned to spend the next 2 days on the beach. But I had heard grave mutterings about the distress of the Secret Service and knew that such distress often alters presidential plans. So I asked him, "Are they going to let you swim tomorrow?" To which he replied, "I think so. Nancy tells me I'm the most powerful man in the world." That amusing declaration uttered by the most self-effacing president of the century nicely situates the question. Can the most powerful man in the world, presiding, however, over a free society, appease conservative appetites? The answer to this, I think, is only in part. If that is so, the logically ensuing question is, well, has he done so? The answer to that is only in part. And this is the text of my lesson today. When Mr. Reagan was elected, we were asked at National Review how we would position our editorial policy with respect to him. I said that we would endeavor to make two measurements. The first being, how is he doing given political reality? And the second is, how is he doing up against the paradigm? There are, I think, three general criteria by which the question posed here tonight is examined. The first is, of course, the domestic management. The second, our foreign policy. The third, his philosophical leadership. Concerning the first, I read only yesterday a manuscript submitted by Professor Hadley Arkes, who served briefly as a speechwriter for the president, is now attached, I think, to Georgetown. I plan to publish that provocative manuscript, in which he makes patiently, affably, and appreciatively certain points about the conservative movement and President Reagan. And he ends by asking, could it really be that the conservative movement stands to be validated or to be discredited according to the price of interest on the 1st of November of this year? He uses this insight to ask questions concerning the Reagan administration's position on certain issues in which he believes, as do I, that certain principles should have been asserted without any reference, or without any necessary reference to their instrumental usefulness. Mr. Arkes uses an analogy as follows. Let us suppose, says he, that many Congresses ago, a general tax was levied at 20% with the following exception, namely that all Americans of Oriental descent should pay 50%. If we had a president who proposed repealing the surcharge on Orientals, it would not be asked what would the effect of this repeal have on the budget or on deficit financing. It would be recognized that to tax one set of people by standards different from the taxes levied on another set of people is simply morally wrong. And without any reference to the empirical effect of righting that wrong, one could suppose that a moral consensus behind that reform could be stimulated. By the same token, Professor Arkes stresses that it is morally wrong to inquire into skin color, morally wrong to exclude on that basis, morally wrong on that basis to go in the opposite direction, and that under the circumstances, a conservative leader ought to make these points because those points, irrespective of his power to effect obliging legislation, are points that need to be made under the circumstances. He professes a disappointment which some of us, I suppose, share at the president's failure simply to point out that it is morally wrong to compel, for instance, busing, to compel, for instance, affirmative action when the state is the instrument of such measures. It is, I think, an unhappy failure of the president to make a philosophical declaration against what Mr. Hayek has singled out as, quote, the most subversive instrument at the disposal of self-government, namely the progressive feature of the income tax. It is his failure to make such declarations unequivocally that has caused so much emphasis to be put on the alleged favoritism he is showing towards the Orientals in our society who pay a different rate of taxation from other people. I don't mean to suggest that the conservative movement ought to disdain pragmatic arguments or empirical administration, empirical arguments. Milton Friedman, several years ago, arguing for a reduction in the top rate of the income tax to 25%, came forward with a fascinating historical example of the extent to which people will exert themselves in order to avoid exposure to a tax rate they consider to be inconsiderate, even inordinate. In 1924, he points out, at $100,000, Americans were subjected to a tax of 25%. In 1924, 15,000 Americans reported themselves as having an income of $100,000 or more. In 1977, the last year for which the complete figures are available, those figures changed in the following way. Americans had increased by 80%, and $100,000 in 1929, thanks primarily to inflation, but thanks also to a real growth in income, had risen to $1 million. How many people then declared themselves in 1977 to have an income of $1 million or more? The corresponding figure would have been 27,000 Americans. The actual figure was 1,785. Now, from this, Milton Friedman concludes, not necessarily that this is a total validation of supply-side economics, but that it is an empirical validation of how people tend to behave in a free society when rates of taxation are discriminatory, and what is their philosophical justification for doing this. 3 years ago, when I was 53, I decided to attempt to put some money aside every year for the benefit of my wife and son. I gave only two instructions to the man who was to handle these exiguous funds. The first was that he should try to do better than inflation and taxes. The second was that he was not to tell me what he did, because I find the whole subject boring. Last week, I received a telephone call from Mr. Margolis of the New York Times to tell me that he had run into a datum early that week, that there had been a ruling by the Internal Revenue Department disqualifying the tax deductions taken by 180 people who had invested in a movie. He asked me, had I ever heard of the movie Rape of the Innocent, in which I had apparently invested. I told him I had not, but that I supposed it was a documentary of the Democratic Party. But the episode, of course, reinforces Mr. Friedman's point and the empirical argument that if the rates were reduced to 25% today, only 13% of existing revenues would be forfeit, instantly to be made up as a result of at least a 10% extra tax base as a result of re-exposure of the kind of people who end up investing in movies in order to search out tax shelters. And since Mr. Reagan communicates so well by anecdote, he might have picked up an episode given by Congressman Phil Graham, as you know, a professional economist. He did, after an experience 6 months ago, do a little work, and he came up with the following rather remarkable figure. The average money bill in Congress costs $50 million. The average beneficiary of those money bills stands to receive $500. These figures, by the way, are gorgeously circular. But the average taxpayer pays for that money bill 50 cents. One can, says Philip Graham, understand the differences in the pressure on our representatives exerted by the people who stand to lose 50 cents over against those who stand to benefit by $500. He illustrated by the fact that the preceding week it had been suggested that in order to save $3 billion, Social Security be indexed not twice a year, but once a year, which measure was passed by an overwhelming voice vote. But then a congressman stood up and said that he insisted on a head count, which was thereupon taken, and the measure lost by 270-80. such empirical arguments are always at the disposal of the Reagan administration, but tend to be primarily useful only to reinforce the philosophical argument. It strikes me that any skeptics in the matter of the Laffer curve can only be skeptical as to its exact configuration. Professor John Kenneth Galbraith recently wrote in the Washington Post that he had been asked by the American Heritage Dictionary, of which he is a consultant, to define supply-side economics, and he had replied by saying that this would not be necessary because by the time the next edition of the dictionary was released, the term would have been entirely forgotten as meaningless indeed. He went so far as to say characteristically that if memory serves, the Laffer curve originated either, he said, memory is insecure here, on a piece of tissue paper, or it was a napkin, or it was a piece of toilet paper. Whichever was the case, they would have better been used conventionally than by Mr. Laffer. The point certainly is that the Laffer curve cannot be laughed out of existence except to the extent that one is willing to say that people are willing to work for nothing. But the mistake, clearly, is to suggest, as some of its advocates have done, that it will act in such a way as instantly to replace funds that are lost through a reduction in taxation. The validity of the Laffer curve is intuitively recognized by people who know how, in fact, they tend to behave and how, in fact, their friends tend to behave. And such arguments are always at the disposal of a president, but are ultimately only appealing to the extent that they are grounded not in instrumental predictions, but in matters of philosophical affirmation. In the matter of foreign affairs, it appears to me that the president has made progress in resuggesting the globalist nature of the challenge. Gerhard Niemeyer so frequently said that what we lost under Lyndon Johnson was primarily that insight, namely that we are fighting at whatever front against a force which is intricately wedded to forces around the world that seek, roughly speaking, the same objective. Now, Senator William Fulbright gave us, I think, a marvelously useful distinction when he wrote 10 years ago that the government of the United States has no proper quarrel with any other government, no matter how odious its policies, unless it seeks to export them. Nothing could have been clearer than the dominance of this codicil when in 1965 we invaded with our Marines the eastern half of a single island because it appeared that there might be a chance that it become a part of that globalist offensive while leaving completely undisturbed the western half in which Papa Doc reigned over a society at least as odiously as any communist. So in Salvador, in Nicaragua, I would say that Mr. Reagan has successfully reinforced the conservative perception of the globalist challenge. His failures are, in my judgment, failures to have mobilized the natural weapons at our resources, at our disposal. They are primarily the economy and the word. We have not revitalized the ideological, to use a suspect word, offensive. We have not given breath to the extent that we are in a position to do so, to that which characterizes the difference between our society with all its shortcomings and life under Gulag. In economics, it seems to me that we have failed to recognize that intervention, for instance, in the matter of agriculture, can be viewed as a paramilitary experiment, if indeed we prevent the Soviet Union from getting $7 or $8 or $9 billion worth of wheat from the United States, from Argentina, from Canada. We are and should judge that as being a defense expenditure to the extent that the number of Russians who are sent back to till the soil are Russians who are not, as of that moment, engaged in making bullets. We have, in fact, advanced the identical goals that are advanced by the construction of one more battleship or aircraft carrier. The failure of the Reagan administration to assert with a resonant seriousness its determination to use the economic weapon has led, for instance, to plans to continue with a pipeline stretching from Siberia to Austria, the effects of which will be not only to bail out the Soviet economic system marginally, but also to transform industries in Western Europe into a reliance on gas, which the Soviet Union is in a position easily to disturb. There looms, of course, the great test in the late part of 1983, when the question is, do we or do we not deploy our Pershing and cruise missiles? It is too early to say whether Western Europe demoralization and presidential leadership will come to the rescue of that critical decision. We do know that Mr. Reagan has, up until this moment, satisfied us of the seriousness of his intentions. On the philosophical issues, there are, of course, many. The one that vexes so many people so acutely is that of abortion. If indeed we are permitting the liquidation of 1.5 million human beings every year, it is difficult to understand any sense of hierarchy that relegates to that act of genocide less than primary importance. But we are, after all, a nation in which even the gradual perception of the evil of slavery was caused a temporization that is consistent with the natural rhythm of this country, so much so that even in mid-war, Abraham Lincoln, who had certainly become the clearest apostle of the essential wrongdoing of slavery, said that his goal was to save the Union even if it remained half slave and half free. It may very well be that notwithstanding the exemplary declarations by the president on the matter of abortion, he recognizes intuitively that until they are shared, it becomes impossible to get the kind of legislation usually preceded by the consolidation of a social sanction which would actually change our position in the matter. As regards prayer and busing, as regards tuition, tax credits, there is progress. It is not a progress that depends, as the economy depends, on this or that a tactical victory of an empirical order, but it is hard, I think, to fault the Reagan administration for being less than properly exercised on these two matters that do relate to our understanding of freedoms that are preserved for the individual. The final question has, of course, to do with the question of when, if ever, would the nuclear bomb be used. My own private conclusion is that the most effective deterrent we have in our arsenal at this moment is not our Minuteman missiles, nor our submarines, nor our Air Force, but Ronald Reagan himself. I say this because Mr. Reagan is a man who long ago came to the, I think, proper conclusion that certain things would not be permitted to happen. And unless in the next period Congress contrives to take the authority away from the president, it is plain that he would use his unique power in order to retaliate in the event of a Soviet economic initiative. I have urged and intend to do so in more elaborately in a few weeks, what I call the demystification of nuclear strategy. Most of the apocalyptic talk we hear is based on a fear that in an exchange the parties would be carried away. As recently as 3 weeks ago, Time magazine described with some specificity the football that follows the president wherever he goes. It is called a football. It is, in fact, a briefcase. What is inside that briefcase was not divulged because no one is supposed to know what it is, but it gives the president all kinds of variable opportunities with which to describe the kind of retaliation with which he would visit, against the Soviet Union in the event of an attack. Now, it is the conventional wisdom taught, no doubt, in the freshman year at West Point, that you keep the enemy guessing. And in point of fact, the president continues to enjoy that proposition that the enemy must never know exactly how far you intend to go. My own feeling is that we have got to jettison that conventional wisdom as inappropriate to the nuclear age. Time magazine described what would happen to the city of Detroit in the event that a single megaton bomb were exploded 7,000 feet above the heart of the city. What would happen is, roughly speaking, that the city would disappear. 350,000 Americans would be killed. What would we then do? We don't know what we would do because the football is a secret document and we are not prepared, we're not supposed to probe its intentional scrutability. I think this incorrect, and have passed along my own recommendations with which I hope some of you would agree, that we open that football and say exactly what we would do. For the sake of shorthand, I call mine the Leningrad Doctrine. because it is a very simple doctrine, namely that any American city that is destroyed by a nuclear Soviet bomb will result in the elimination of the city of Leningrad. That all the orders to that effect have gone out, that it is not necessary to reconfirm them, and that under the circumstances we have only to assert our willingness to prevent the elimination of an American city by singling Leningrad out as that city which would disappear in the event of that offensive. It has, to me, certain obvious advantages. One is that there is a moral symmetry. One is that you eliminate the time in which the moral transaction takes place, in which, having sustained damage, you need to make the moral commitment to inflict damage, the moral redundancy of which might strike some people as immoralizing that particular act. Under the Lenin doctrine, these would be automatic. There would be certain ancillary advantages, for instance, for all we know, the growth of a peace movement in Leningrad. I think it unwise, ladies and gentlemen, to choose the moment to reflect that it was written that this world would one day end. It is, I think, blasphemous to anticipate the Lord's hand in any such eschatological undertaking. We do right to wish to survive, but merely to make that statement is not to cope with misgivings that creep into the body politic and which Ronald Reagan is uniquely situated to withstand. Our conservatism cannot retreat from its traditional position that some things are worth dying for. The special challenge of the time is the proposition that although some things may be worth dying for, it is not worth dying for nothing, which is what would be left in the event of a nuclear exchange. All the strategic wit at our resources must be summoned to prevent such an exchange, but the deepest reserves of that wit is a willingness to say acquiescently that yes, rather a nuclear exchange than the sale of our souls to the Faustian monsters who sit unsmiling behind their hydrogen missiles, seeking to mastermind the greatest act of human choreography in the history of the world. Jonathan Schell calculates that the explosive power of the present inventory of nuclear weapons worldwide is equal to 600 million times the force that exploded over Hiroshima. That datum, which has stormed the consciences of so many readers, means very little, I think, to us, because we dredge up from the macro horrors which we are so constantly exposed the one relevant datum, namely that if the Soviet Union opted for massive nuclear war, our option must be to return that hell in kind. And this option we would need to choose for so simple a reason as that we would not then have died for nothing, because it is better than nothing to rid the world of such monsters as would unleash such a war. It is needlessly distracting to multiply the figures so as to deal with hundreds of millions of people when the poetry of the cosmic situation is reducible to the single apprehensible vision of a single man resolved that he will not leave his family to the mercy of a monster. It is, I think, rather the imagination of the conservative whose knowledge is of the permanent things, and who always has acknowledged that death is not the primary human affliction, than that of the positivist, whose values are finally so pliable as to guide them not merely to sell their souls, but to grant to the purchasers dominion over the whole world. Rather to the conservatives that we turn for moral guidance. I have said that I don't doubt that Ronald Reagan has intuitively reached the correct conclusion, and derivatively that so long as he has, we are effectively protected. But he terribly needs our help, because it is charted more exactly than the next eclipse of the sun that the great tidal wave of pacifism is about to hit us, and its force generated by such great passions as human fear, as the biological yearning to survive, the sense, however misdirected, of human altruism will be great, but for so long as such as you live, work, and contend, this tidal wave will not overwhelm us, and then I think it will once again have become safe to speak of generations of Americans yet unborn, who, experiencing liberty, will be grateful that at the threatened nightfall, the blood of their forefathers ran strong.